Hi everyone, and welcome to what is a particularly different interview this week as part of my series of podcasts on nostalgia, because this time I'm the guest. Pamela Petra, who I interviewed a few months ago, turned the tables on me, and I have to say, listening back to the interview now after we recorded it in October, I'm surprised, not in a bad way, at quite how much I revealed about myself and the interest that I have in broadcasting and how I ended up in academia, and whether there are any dreams which I had when I was young that I still have today. But also I talk about my diary and something that happened to me around 2016, 2017, which a few people who are close to me know lots and lots about, but I haven't necessarily shared with the world, even if I do share quite a lot of my own experiences on social media. So this was quite a different experience for me. It was quite cathartic, and I think it's probably best if I stop talking and I allow Pamela Petro to take over and interview me as part of the Nostalgia Interviews with Christy C podcast.
Okay, so Chris, let's get going. Let's just start with the simplest question. When and where were you born?
Well, thank you, Pamela. And you're right, because the simplest question often is the one that is the most tricky in some ways, because, you know, well, where does one start? Well, no, in my case, it was Cardiff. It was 1973. And I always dumbfound a few people because they say, but you don't sound Welsh. And yet, for the first 31 years of my life, I lived and indeed was educated, because obviously we have a Lampeter connection, in Wales. So it's only since I was 31 that I've been living in England.
And how is that you don't have Welsh in your voice?
Well, there is an explanation which sounds more like me trying to read back into my life something that I'd love to be the sort of the epitome of, you know, how I got to where I am. And it's this radio obsession that I had, because my parents, I mean, they don't sound super Welsh. They are Welsh, and you can definitely pick up a Welsh accent. So I don't think it's the case that I came from a place where I sounded completely different from everyone else. But radio was always this fixation. And what I used to do, and of course, it's easy to talk about this now. At the time, people would have thought, that's a really weird thing to do. But I used to read out, you know, remember the teletext pages?
Yeah.
Where you'd read the news in the days before social media, before the internet. So what I would always do is read the news. I used to record lots of radio programs. I used to record for my grandparents a weekly show. I think I called it the Weekly Super Show. And it was just for them. And with music, with all the records I bought from Woolworths that week, and I'd introduce them. And they loved it. But of course, I think they were a bit bewildered as to why I would do, you know, it was a radio show just for two people. And it'd be like,
I'm sure they were enchanted.
I think they loved it. I think my grandmother genuinely thought that actually was going out on the radio, because she was like, oh my God, you know, it sounds good, doesn't it? You know, it's like, it is literally just for you. Anyway, so I would do that and intersperse it with lots of music and various maybe cassette recordings, or, you know, I'd record stuff from the radio and I'd insert this into the program I did for them. But I was doing that from such a young age that I think that even when I listened to things that I recorded when I was at Lampeter, because I used to do the same thing sometimes. I used to sometimes just try and, you know, help if I was giving a presentation. And it's actually a really good skill that I tell my students to use, which is to read your essays out loud.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And I've got recordings of that. And my voice sounds like, if I listen to my 1991 self, I sound like a TV newsreader.
I see. So your influence, rather more than your parents or the people around you, was actually the media.
Yeah. And I think it must be, because when I listen to those tapes, from even when I was, say, 18, certainly when I was younger, I was trying to emulate those great radio presenters and the newsreaders. And I think from a young age, there was a part of me that thought, that's what I want to do. But it's not that I had a career plan of action. It's not as though I thought from a young age, you know, I'm going to be there. It's what I want. Everyone knew I wanted to do it. But
How did you then wind up teaching in the university rather than on the news?
I know. And that's a question. And I think this is my midlife crisis. Being in my late 40s.
We've gone right to the point.
Yeah, but I think because I do these interviews, and I've done more than 120 of them to date, this, and the reason I keep doing them, because, you know, even when I'm so busy. And I sometimes think, you know, I really have to do ABC. When I'm not doing these interviews, I feel there's something missing. It's almost as though I need this to give me some sort of counterpoint or some sort of balance to everything else going on. What is interesting is that that dream never went away. And all through my life, you know, the sort of collection of old radio programs, stuff I listened to in the car, old tapes I digitized, it's almost as though, without ever having listened to other people's podcasts, I was interviewed by somebody about 2017 from another university who wanted to talk about my research and teaching. And I did this. And I thought, I'd love to be on the other side of the microphone. And I knew then that this was, and so I actually said to her afterwards, you know, which technology did you use? Which instruments did you use? Which is the best sort of software? And how do you do it? How do you connect it to your computer? And how do you put out a podcast? Anyway, so it all followed from there. So what I was aware of is from my mid-40s or so, I was suddenly doing the things that from a young age I always wanted to do, which is to broadcast, to interview. Mm-hmm. Of course, the one thing I'm not doing is playing records or the equivalent thereof today. So that kind of completes the circle. Why I went into university, there is a part of me that has always taken the slightly more careful path. So going to university at 18, it was like that to me felt like a great achievement in the sense that I was so convinced, as you know, I'm not alone in that, because I know from my own students what a struggle it can be sometimes. And you know, imposter syndrome, or you just don't feel that you did as well in your exams as you
wish. We all feel that way, I think.
Yeah. So I chose to go to Lampeter. I went there. It was a fantastic experience. Suddenly the difference from school was phenomenal, but suddenly it was like, I don't have to listen to what my teacher tells me, and I don't have to then write it down because that's the answer to the question. I'll do my own investigation. So suddenly I became somebody who really found research fascinating.
Research was just as seductive in a way as was broadcasting and music. Yeah. And they go together.
And they do, because I also, this is the funny thing as well, because I used to go to my local church in Cardiff, an Anglican church, and I kind of stopped at the time I went to university, because suddenly I was able to do through my essays, through my seminars and lectures and all that, what I had previously tried to fathom from a Sunday morning worship experience, where I sometimes came away with, you know, I knew what the right things to do were, the right rituals to go up to Holy Communion, but I didn't really understand what was going on behind it. So university was seductive. University made me suddenly think, this is an opportunity for me to grow, to develop, to write on things that interest me. And then before I knew it, I went to do a master's, I did a PhD, and then kind of ensured that career-wise, I was qualified to do nothing other than work in higher education.
You suddenly realize, yes, this is what I have to do now.
Yeah. So I was narrowing down my options. Yeah. And so suddenly at that age in my 20s, going into radio seemed a little odd, considering, you know, you don't need a PhD in religious studies in order to have that career. So it's not that the dream of radio ever went away. It's just that I'd created a new set of skills that were more immediate and which in a way were very good on a CV, whereas the radio interest always felt like a hobby from childhood.
Did you come to radio through music? Or through news broadcasts or both?
Yeah, I have a feeling that when I was really young, I was listening to it was on Radio 4 in those days, and it was maybe it was preschool, because I remember listening. Well, my mum was getting ready maybe there was a school pickup. I've got a sister who's a few years older. And I remember listening to one weekday afternoon, a children's program on Radio 4, maybe a book reading, and it completely connected with me. And I listened to that, and I thought far more than, you know, I actually was standing over, and I know I did this because family members would sometimes say, you know, just you, do you know what you look like? Because I'd be literally hovering over the radio with my hands out. I was just absorbing every word. But very quickly, that became music radio. So maybe somebody else had introduced me to the charts on a Sunday. So it was Tony Blackburn on Radio 1 in those days who would count down the charts. And I had an older sister who used to buy some of the records from that period. And suddenly, of course, I'd be listening to the radio, to the charts. And I'd say, you know that record that you bought? Because I was probably about 6 at this point, so I probably didn't articulate it in the way that I'm indicating. But suddenly, all these records that she was interested in talking about and sharing with me, maybe in the charts. And I'd say, oh, you know that record that you liked? it's the highest new entry, or it's gone up to number 7, and it may even be next week's number 1. So if anything, I was more interested in that than her. So she bought the music, and then for me, having it played on the radio was a kind of corroboration. It was like, if they played it on the radio, it's made it. If it's at the top of the charts, then in some way that sort of validates it. So it also validates people's choices. So playground discussions were full of all of that. My favorite record has gone down 4 places. Yours has gone up 3 places. So there was that science sense of dynamics in the playground really sort of played out around music.
That's so interesting to me, because I did it the other way around. I would hear things on the radio and then go buy the records. But I also had older brothers, and they introduced me to a lot of music too.
Yeah, I suppose I did listen to when I heard the stuff on the radio, because obviously not all of the stuff was what my sister had bought. But then, yeah, if I heard it on the radio, I'd want to have a physical version of it. I suppose in the same way that in more recent years, I would buy lots of films, and having them on VHS or in later years, Blu-ray or DVD. So having like a concrete version of it. So I'd have it on the radio. I might even naughtily record it off the radio, but I still want to have the proper version of it. So I could say, you know, this represents the song, Kirsty MacColl, Bucks Fizz, Shakin' Stevens, whatever it was. This represents in my hand what I listened to. And that concrete version of it sort of gave it a certain substance.
Reality, meaning. Yep. So now I'm interested in broadcast media with images. When did you bring your interest in radio to the television? Were you as intrigued and seduced by the images, or was it always the sound, the music, the broadcast?
Yeah, that is such a good question, because I think sometimes it was both, because there would always be programs on TV, and it was often around Thursday nights. It was Top of the Pops, or some of my more scientifically leaning friends would be watching Tomorrow's World, which was far more learned than anything I'd watch it, but they understood it, whereas I was just watching it and thinking, oh gosh, look at the way that the presenters, you know, you'd have some very dynamic and perhaps eccentric presenters who kind of made it worth watching in those days. And when I was a bit later, things like Question Time, so the more politics-based programs. So TV played a huge part, but it's interesting that it was often the musical version on TV of what I was listening to on the radio. So the sort of Saturday morning children's TV, where all the pop acts would do a more children-friendly version of their stage performances. And actually, it was funny, not too many months ago, coming across acts like the Human League instead of appearing on Saturday morning television. It was like, you know, they were real cutting-edge stuff, but they'd be on a program that the target audience was 7 or 8-year-olds. Perhaps they also hoped that the parents would be watching and would also be interested in following through and, you know, buying the Dare album or whatever it was. So I was always really interested in the presentational side of things. And perhaps actually to a point that, you know, sometimes I'd think, oh, I'd love to read the news on the TV. But of course, there was also a part of me that also knew that reading the news is one thing, but understanding it, you know, being a good journalist is another. And not all journalists are necessarily good newsreaders. And some of the best newsreaders we've ever had, at the end of the day, are reading a script that somebody else has written. And it's a presentational job. And that's what I knew from the get-go. And I think that's carried with me into teaching. That
I was going to say, that's the bridge into teaching and research and explication. Yeah.
My teaching is a playing, and I know it is. Apart, I always joke sometimes, and I've said this in some of my interviews, that apart from the weather or the music or the traffic reports, when I'm giving one of my lectures, I feel that I'm imbibing not just the people who taught me, for example, at Lampeter, but also those radio heroes, because the hook is that you've got a class in front of you and you have to make it exciting and dynamic. And if you don't do that, it's like, why would you listen? It's the equivalent of switching off a radio show. That's not to say that my lectures are always dynamic and entertaining. I'm very
sure. They are.
Well, historically, I would be so nervous. I sometimes be sort of reading this script of somebody else's words, of, you know, quotations, and, you know, sometimes you're aware that you're sort of regurgitating the words of whoever the theorist is that week, and it's, but maybe doing it in your own voice. So I suppose in that sense, there was an element of saying, what is the point of connection? And that was where the enthusiasm, I suppose, came out. But so the bridge between the two, I think, is actually quite, looking back anyway, quite an obvious one.
Yes, as you're discussing it, I can see how your profession is performative, it's research-based, it's engaging an audience. Yeah. And that's what you've been interested from the beginning.
And it's never gone away. And that's why even like during lockdown, I suppose teaching, being able to teach online was actually a wonderful thing to do. But also because I was so used to having a class in front of me, to suddenly find yourself having to do your job without an audience at first felt really horrifying because I'd never done anything like it. Mm-hmm. It didn't take me long to realize that in recording my radio, so I just said it, recording my radio shows, recording my lectures, I was doing them like a radio show because I'd watch myself back. And actually, I don't watch all of my lectures. With my podcast, it's a different thing and I have to because I'm editing them. But I'm not sure I have the time or the inclination to watch all of my lectures that I've done. But the bits that I do see, yeah, when I'm watching them, I sometimes see somebody who's treating this as if I was on the TV or on the radio and really getting very animated and excited.
But how wonderful for your students.
Yeah. Well, I'd never thought so lockdown actually made me think that. It wasn't something that I'd ever thought about before. It was only when I was actually watching myself delivering and thinking, what are my students seeing? And, you know, good heavens, what are they thinking? That I thought, gosh, you know, it's, and I saw myself in a way that they obviously are used to seeing me, but I'd never really thought that through because I'm not used to seeing myself deliver a lecture.
I love these parallels. This is just fascinating to me. Tell me this, your interest in music and film, I want to get to that connection to film too. Do you use music and film as tools in your teaching? Do you bring it that word and image into your class?
Clips I do, particularly for a module I teach on religion and film, where if we're looking at, I don't know, a biblical epic, then of course I need to show the students who in many cases won't have seen the films. That's mm-hmm. the ironic thing. I'm aware that often the examples I give are films that I saw 30 years ago. So I say, I'll talk about The Shawshank Redemption, which came out when I was at university. They're looking at me thinking, oh, I wasn't even born then. So I do use...
It's shocking. That's shocking. I talked about Meryl Streep the other day and the students just looked, who?
Yeah.
And I mean, that's just a stake through my heart, but... Yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, not at all. Well, I hope that they've seen at least Mamma Mia. I'm sure that they would have, because if they watched Mamma Mia, it may not be Meryl Streep that they necessarily associate with that. I would.
Exactly.
And I think for me, when I saw the first Mamma Mia film, and of course she only has a cameo role really in the second, I was so blown away by her performance. But of course, that's not to say that everybody who watches the film was getting the same thing out of it as I was. Yeah, generationally, as you say, Meryl Streep might mean something different to somebody in their teens now, to somebody in their 40s or 50s.
Exactly. But so you do bring in film and music as well?
Yeah, sometimes I feel I ought to do it more because I always think that, and this is also because it wasn't the way I was kind of brought up when I was being taught by my peers, my peers, that they weren't my peers then, they might be now. But to use clips or jingles sort of thing, I wonder if there is a place. I think there is a place for that because sometimes there's a point of connection. I mean, it's okay for me in my office now when I can do that sort of thing on my keyboard. If I'm in a lecture theatre, sometimes I used to find this with when the technology was just a VHS, cassette, and there might be a TV monitor in the room. I'd get going and be doing my spiel with the students, and then I'd say, and here's a clip, and then there'd be silence. And it's like, if you're doing a radio show, the worst thing is silence. And I'm good at filling a gap, but if I'm also then doing all the technology and I'm having to put and then it's not working, the sound's not working.
That's a technical issue. Yeah.
So I kind of felt that, and some of my students, and I personally don't see this as a bad thing, but they might say, oh, I thought we'd be watching more films. And I'd think, but what you actually get is me talking for 2 hours. But I also then give them all the clips to the films, which we may or may not look at. Mm-hmm. We don't look at all of them in the class. But I absolutely do break it up and I do put clips in, as you say, in my teaching.
I just wondered, because as you've been talking, I was thinking that my partner, Marguerite, teaches Portuguese and Brazilian studies. And she teaches both upper level courses on topics, but she teaches entry-level Portuguese as well. And always ask the students, what brought you to Portuguese? Because it's not one of the typical languages that you would come to university to learn. And they say music, almost always. And so she has redesigned her course to be Portuguese through music. And she uses Brazilian music especially as the entryway into the language.
Yeah.
So that opened my eyes to the use of music and image in teaching.
Yeah, because it's interesting how when I was younger, we didn't really at university have seminars to the extent that we do now. So for the first few years that I was in my present job, I'm not sure in all honesty that I could tell you that there was a great difference between a lecture and a seminar. A seminar was often a continuation of the discussions that would begin in the lecture. I think now these days we have to have them far more compartmentalized and clearly structured. And that's actually a good thing because it means that I have to make sure that I do something that is a genuinely seminar-based rather than lecture-based event. But when I was at university, we had very few seminars. And I'm not, this is in no way a criticism, but what would happen, you'd have some wonderful people like Paul Badham or D.P. Davis in Lampeter, who would teach in their very idiosyncratic ways, very engaging. So even their lectures had an element of engagement with them and participation in them. But what I was conscious of is that they would stand for an hour or whatever it was, and then they would communicate. And we would all assiduously write down notes. And of course, the more notes we wrote, the more we felt that we'd got a real grasp of what was being discussed. We didn't record in those days. And so in a way, the lecture was the primary mode of delivery. Seminars have their place, but, and this is an example that I found, an example just a few years ago. A student who, for whatever reason, wasn't able to come to the lectures. I think the lectures were at 9 a.m. and just whatever reason, it just didn't work out. But the seminar was at something like 4 p.m. So she came to all the seminars, but not the lectures. And so what she was doing is trying to learn what was the topic of the module from the seminars. But what she was getting was often other students giving presentations. And she once said, but the quality is, is mixed. And she said, and I thought, yeah, okay, it's like, well, you, she said, but I don't feel I'm learning as much as I want to. And I thought, but I've just given a 2-hour lecture, which you,
that you didn't attend.
And that is me just talking for 2 solid hours. And the seminar is a way of the students then having to unpack all of that and deliver in their own mode.
Right.
So that for me is interesting, that for me, the primary method is actually a lecture, but an engaged lecture. Ironically, doing the pre-recorded lectures on Zoom during lockdown, I thought at first, I'll run out of things to say after half an hour, because how can I do a 2-hour lecture without an audience? I'm still going at 1 hour 45. So without the audience in front of me, I'm still sort of, it's the imaginary audience that is sustaining me.
How about now going back to your undergraduate days? What was, when I say that, what's your first memory? Is it academic? Is it social? Is it?
Well, the first memory of going there, and it was, and I tell you the day, it was the 4th of October. It was a Friday. It was 1991. And my parents drove me. I remember the day vividly. And I also remember also what was on the radio that day. Maybe that's something that will come up later. Go on.
What was it?
It was Ed Stoiber. Okay, as I was leaving, my grandparents lived across the road. And so I said goodbye to them. And they had Radio 2 on. And it was a weekday morning request show with a guest presenter that month, October 91, called Ed Stewart, who is my radio hero. Now, Ed Stewart, at various moments in my life, at key moments, was on the radio. It just, and he was also what was on the radio the day I was born in 1973. And I wrote a book a few years ago on Christmas, and I had a whole chapter on this. So it was almost as though this big new start, going to university, suddenly going into the big bad world almost of, not being with my parents, not having my washing done for me or whatever, my food cooked for me. But then having the radio. And all the way through that first month, because obviously I'd go to lectures and seminars, or not seminars as it may have been. But when I was in my room, the radio was always on in the background. If I'm honest, perhaps it was on in the foreground and everything else was in the background.
Do you work with the radio on?
Yes, I did for many years. I did when I did my PhD, I did. These days, not so much. And I think I don't know. I listen to the radio, but and of course, you can listen to programs back in a different mode. And I think because you've got the catch up facilities, I listen there. And in my office, of course, I have opportunity through whether it's checking email or, of course, I check the BBC News, etc. So there are always things to sort of not distract me, but sort of in between a task, you might just check the news or listen to something and then carry on. But in those
okay, things, but go back to radio, now. Go back to your so you get to Lampeter and this is he's on the radio and
this is all on. And then I remember because my sister, who's 3 years older, was also at Lampeter. She had just started a master's course and I was there to do an undergraduate. And I remember this is such a strange memory of going with my parents to, do you remember William C. Price, which was, he was the funeral home, but in Lampeter, but he also ran a store that sold furniture and
beds. Yes.
And we went there to get a bed for my sister. And because she was living in a place that I think if there was a bed, it was a very old rickety thing. And my parents said, oh, you know, you can't sleep there. We want to get you a good bed. So it was delivered that afternoon by William C. Price himself. So my first day at university was kind of also ensuring that my sister was properly facilitated. So it was sort of my first day, but also her continuation. But it was sort of like both of us having to be kind of sorted out at the same time. This is what I remember. My parents leaving, and it was on Station Terrace. Susan was listening at this house called Avondale, right at the top of there by the
Coal Merchant. I can picture it clearly. Yeah.
And my parents were going, and I don't know if I've ever had this conversation with my sister or my parents, but my parents said that they were going to stop off, I think it was somewhere like Llandovery, to get some fish and chips, because obviously it had been a long day and they needed to stop off on the way back to Cardiff. I think my sister had said something like, oh, I think Chris is going to cry or whatever. It was like, you know, because you're going and, you know, very sad. Right. And she meant it in the sense of, oh, you're going. It's an emotional moment. But I was, at that moment, and I'm glad I didn't, but at that moment, so Friday, 4th of October, probably about, I don't know, 6 or 7 in the evening, I would have done anything to have got in the car with them and had them, you know, had fish and chips with them in Llandovery.
Yep.
And I realized I'd never properly ever been away from home. Suddenly they were going, and they were, you know, at the end of the day, unlike yourself when you were in a different country, my parents were an hour and 45 minutes away. But for me, it might as well have been New Jersey. I was in this position of even having my sister there, which was in that sense, I had a close family member who was literally living, just, you know, nearby. But for me, I knew that was the beginning of the rest of my life, because suddenly all those expectations and everything is done for you. The food on the table, the laundry, you know, the time to watch TV, it was always a communal thing with my parents. Suddenly I was on my own.
Now, and you'll never be that child again.
Never again.
You'll never be under their care in that way again.
And that's why, interestingly, although to this day, I mean, my parents are now in their, well, late 70s in my mum's case, 80 in my dad's case, I'm very close to them, but living with them again would never be an option, because we've all moved on.
No, everybody's moved on.
Yeah.
But it's the blowing apart of that nuclear family, that closeness, that first unit that you're part of, and the unconditional love, hopefully, that, you know, in both our cases, comes along with that.
That's right. Because I cried. I think it was the Wednesday. The lectures for me started on the Thursday. And the following Wednesday, I was just like, I'm in this strange place. And it wasn't that strange, because I had a sister. I look back and think, you know, it was a small place. And she'd been there before me. I'd visited there before. So it wasn't that strange a place. But I think I needed just to sort of work out what I was doing, where I was. But I'm not joking. That was a cleansing thing, because once I sort of just felt a bit sort of overwhelmed. I mean, so many people told me the same story that they welled at.
I had the same story in Lampeter.
Yeah. And then once
you move on.
Move on. And I never looked back. And that is the crucial bit. Suddenly it was like, this is going to work. This is really
good. Yes. And then you get excited.
And then the thought of going back to your parents was no longer an option. That wouldn't just be regressive, but also it would have felt like you were squandering all the hopes, dreams, and possibilities. Because what would I have done in the real world?
Which is why when I left Lampeter to go back to New Jersey, I felt exactly that. Now, you said there was a song on the radio. There's a new article in the current New Yorker about the new documentary by the guy who did the Lord of the Rings films.
Oh, Peter Jackson.
Yes, about the Beatles last concert. It's brand new, and I will send you this article if I can. The author, who's the editor of the New Yorker, talks about, I'll just read you this paragraph. To retrieve the memories and sensations of the past, Proust relied mainly on the taste of crumbly cakes moistened with lime blossom tea. The rest of humanity relies on songs. Songs are emotionally charged and brief, so we remember them whole, the melody, the hook, the lyrics, where we were, what we felt, and they are emotionally adhesive, especially when we encounter them in our youth.
You've summed up exactly why you can return and again to a song in a way that nobody would question. I mean, you know what it's like when people will say, and my parents used to say this sometimes, so why would you watch that film again? You've already watched it once. Or, you know, well, you know, surely there are other films to watch. You know, you've seen it.
The universe of thought and emotion around it.
Yeah. Right? And also, if it's had that big impact on you, then surely you want to re-engage with it rather than just say, oh, that was the most overwhelming experience of my life. Well, I will never go anywhere near it again.
I'll never do that again.
So, but you wouldn't say to somebody who likes the Beatles, you wouldn't say, oh, you like Eleanor Rigby, but you've heard it. You heard it when you were 10 years of age. Well, why would you want to do it again? You know, it's a nonsensical argument. And I've said this in some of my own interviews that Paul Simon, I read an interview with Paul Simon some years ago where he said that whenever he's driving across America, he always listens to a station that plays music from, I think it was something like 1957. And I thought, no, that's very specific. And actually, I think he just turned 80 this week. So he would have been born in 41. So he would have been about 16.
Wow.
And that's the answer. So at the age of 16, that was it. And when I was 16, I was listening to a lot of stuff, 1989 in my case. And I can remember to this day the charts of Roy Orbison, You Got It, or Michael Ball, or Sonia, or Shakespeare's Sister, all of this stuff that was in the charts.
And so what was the song from Lampeter? What if you could go back to a song that sums up your undergraduate, like an undergraduate moment of real meaning? Or just adheres to something, what would it be?
That is such a good question, because the stuff I listened to then was often older stuff off the radio. So I was the odd person, inverted commas, who was living, you know, somebody who in the 80s would write down the charts every week. There I was in the early 90s listening to Helen Shapiro, Roy Orbison, the Everly Brothers, Buddy Holly. So there was stuff which completely out of a different era.
That's fine.
Yeah, and it might be something by, for example, Matt Monro, I suspect, because that was stuff that I used to listen to in my room in my first year. Lots of Petula Clark as well. And it was just stuff that from my parents' generation.
Uh-huh.
And I think what happened is there was me in my own life forging my own future at university, doing a degree which no one else in my family, well, my sister aside, no one else in my family had done. And here I was, channeling the music, the enthusiasm, the experiences of then. So even in those days, the connection was through the music. So the stuff on the radio would be the stuff on some level I'd think, I wonder if my parents are listening at this moment. So that was the point of connection, that I'd think, oh, that's their favorite song, or they love this record. And there I would be at the age of 18 or 19 and listening to all of this.
Lovely that is. You should write a book about this, she said. I just have to share this, that my song for Lampeter is a song I don't even like particularly, but I'm standing in the Ram, maybe, or maybe it's the Kumon Tavern, and Uptown Girl by Billy Joel is playing. And it was the incredible juxtaposition of being in this small rural community as an American, marooned alone without any other Americans around, hearing a song about where I came from, kind of. And it was so, it didn't feel odd so much as like a synthesis of my whole life. And I hear that and I'm right back in the pub again.
Do you know, I'm glad that you narrowed it down, because I've now got two very specific answers from that period.
Okay.
One was the Christmas, actually, I don't think it was a number one, maybe it was a number two, but it was Christmas 1991. Do you remember the KLF with Tammy Wynette?
And yes.
Justified and Ancient. And of course, you know, in the years, I think the KLF were saying that, you know, she never knew what she was doing. She'd signed up to this project. She had all this Moo Moo Land in the ice cream van. The song was such a strange mishmash of styles that I was listening to that in my first year at Lampeter and thinking, this song, which is kind of not my sort of music necessarily, but because Tammy Wynette was involved in it, somehow that was the bridge to an older era. And it was such a crazy song that was sort of like the stuff that I'd been listening to in that first year at Lampeter.
Yep.
The other one was an arts hall disco, and it would have been Christmas 92, so Christmas of my second year. And what happened is that in those days, because I wrote a book on Christmas a few years ago, in Lampeter, you'd have an arts or Christmas thing, but there was nothing Christmassy about the music. It was just that it was Christmas time and it'd be like house right. music or whatever. Now, fine, but that wasn't my sort of music. And I was there thinking, oh, I came here to dance. I can't dance full stop, but I thought I'm not going to dance to this. I'll only dance to something that I feel I own, as it were.
Right.
And then suddenly they played The Human League, Don't You Want Me, which was number one in 81, Christmas number one.
Yes.
And that did
iconic it. Song of that summer of 1982 to me.
Yeah. And it came on and they played it. And suddenly there was me who, to this day, this is not me being modest, I cannot dance. I just went onto the dance floor and I knew I had 3 minutes and that yep. they would go back to whatever. And I did my thing. And one friend said to me afterwards, who was also doing theology, her name was Rachel. And I remember she came up and she said, I always really liked Rachel, but I was, you know, I never sort of, you know, had much of a conversation with her before. And she said, well, you looked as though you were enjoying yourself. And I think it was meant in a very sort of dear compliment, but it was more like, good for you.
You finally enjoyed yourself. Good for you. You get it.
And then they said, oh, the three of us, I think it was her friend Becky and there was someone else. And she said, we're actually going to go for a drink to the, where was it? The pub at the top of North Road, the Quarry.
The following
week. And she said, do you want to join us? So suddenly in some strange incongruous way, me dancing terribly to The Human League resulted opened in an invitation to have a drink.
Did you go?
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember we went to play pool, ha, 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 playing pool let's put it this way, playing pool just meant holding the cue and just hoping maybe as long as you don't pot the white, then maybe you've achieved something. And all I remember is just talking till about one in the morning. And it was just talking as people do. But suddenly, you know, outside of the normal sort of environment of the lectures and just enjoying the company, three female friends. And just sitting there or standing there playing pool. And suddenly it just felt like, oh, I'm enjoying, I don't know where this conversation is going. And that's the day I remember. And all these years later, and it was in the, so we were around the sort of 15th or so of December, maybe a little bit before that, maybe the 11th or something of 1992. It was a Tuesday evening. And all these years later, sometime around that date, around the 11th, as you're heading towards Christmas and the nights are very, very dark, sometimes I'll be perhaps in the car driving home and I'm reminded that I palpably feel in a way that, you know, any other time of the year, you think, well, that's just a Christmas memory and, you know, you don't, mm-hmm. it doesn't have any great sort of existential impact. But there was something that happened that night, just clicking with three people, having a nice chat. And they were sort of very disarming and talking about their relationship experiences or what they really thought about the lecturers and about the course. So, you know, very sort of like frank conversations at the moment. All these years later, we're now talking almost three decades later, always around that time of year, I'm always taken back to that evening when mm-hmm. we were, and I even remember what was on the jukebox. And it also, because the Quarry used to have this reputation of being like a biker's club.
Yeah, I remember.
But in those days, I think they were new managers. There was a family who took over, and I think the bikers were shunned. And they had, and this is also like in the Quarry of all places, and I'm not making it up, Whitney Houston's, you know, the big number one from The Bodyguard, I Will Always Love You.
That was on the...
Yeah, and it may have been Shakespeare's Sister and Stay and a couple of other things. Maybe Cliff Richard and Van Morrison were there. But there was a music jukebox and we would put our 50p's in, whatever it was. So all these years later, when I hear that music, again, it's like that night. And of course, people have memories of the Quarry, but they're not that memory. Their memory of the Quarry, in later years, I went there because I was in Lampeter for 10 years. And, you know, and sometimes there'd be fights breaking out on a Friday night. And
right. I think of the Quarry as the rough pub.
Yeah.
So I have a question for you. Now, as you were talking, there's another bridge I would like to cross. Do you think, I mean, this podcast is about nostalgia. Hmm. You think a lot about nostalgia. Do you think you came to nostalgia through your very deeply felt experiences around music?
Yes, and also of Lampeter, because there was a period in my life, I mean, it's interesting though, because Facebook has kind of helped bring me back into contact with many of those friends from yesteryear. But what I think happened about 5 or 6 years ago is that I didn't really have much of a connection with anyone from that period. And I wasn't on Facebook, but people would often talk about how they reconnected with people that they went to school or university with. And I thought, I wouldn't mind opening that door, mark the past. And also my way of dealing with things in the present, because I was not in a very happy place in that period, was to think back to those just and this is the thing. And it wasn't the big momentous events. It was the coffees or the drinks that you'd have in people in their living rooms, in their kitchens, down the student union in Goth's Corner or wherever it may have been. And it was those conversations that all those years later, that the everyday, the humdrum, the prosaic stuff, that was the stuff that I wanted to return to. So it wasn't the big, it wasn't the graduation ceremonies. It wasn't the lectures or the gigs or whatever it was, important though they were. I just wanted the connection with the people who... And I wanted almost to say thank you to them. I think it's a way of saying, you know, because of those conversations, one friend, I'll give you an example. She was same age as me. And her, I think she was adopted and she was going through a period of, and it was emotionally exhausting, I think, for her to try and work out who her birth parents were and whether she should contact them. So that was a big deal for her.
Yeah.
She also wanted to do something completely different in the other side of the world. And I think she ended up at one point working on a kibbutz in Israel. I think she also worked in Australia. So she wanted to travel, but her boyfriend wanted her to marry him. And she came to me. I mean, I'm sure she asked other people as well, but she said to me one day, she said, do you have a few moments to talk? And she told me, and I was sort of 19 or 20. I had no experience of the world. But when she first asked if I thought she should marry her boyfriend, part of me thought, oh, you know, I don't know if I can answer. But suddenly we were talking back and forth about why she might be having those doubts and what she wanted to do, whether it was the right moment for her and whether this was going to fit with her life or career plans. And I think it was pretty clear that actually short term, it may have been good. And she could put on a nice face and said, yes, I'm engaged and it's really good. But it's clear that that would have had a rock. And so I don't know entirely what happened after that. But certainly what I really treasured was the fact that somebody confided in me on that.
Mm-hmm.
All those decades later, it was a way of me, because I was a senior tutor here at the University of Kent for many years. And I was dealing with people coming to talk about their issues around absenteeism, or there may be issues to do with what was going on at home or family issues.
All kinds of things.
All sorts of things, illnesses. And it took me back to being 19 or 20 with zero world experience, it felt. And yet I was having, those are the sort of conversations I was having with people. And I felt privileged that somebody actually, and it wasn't just a random question. I think she thought, she thought that I might be somebody who
she valued your opinion. Yeah. And yeah, at that time, I mean, these are huge decisions and really shared by people who are just out of childhood.
Yeah.
And yeah, we think deeply on our own behalf, but also for others. And you make those connections.
Yeah.
And those factors don't come together again, really, in our lives in quite the same, with quite the same ferocity, intensity.
Yeah. And it was almost my way of saying that, although it's not a direct correlation, because of what had happened all the way back then in the early 90s, the stuff I'm doing now and my ability to do it and the confidence I have in myself to do it kind of goes all the way back to those sort of events. And it was my way of wanting to say, and I never caught up with her again, which was a pity, but there are many other people from that period I did. So there was a part of me that needed to reconnect desperately, because I knew, and this is what my interest in nostalgia is, that whole sort of bittersweetness. Is it a good experience? Is it a bad experience? It's actually a bit of both, because there's a melancholia, there's a longing for something that you once had or thought you had, but you don't have now. And that was it. And that was encapsulated in my time in Lampeter, and also all the music and the sounds and the films from that era, which in many cases I was studying and researching as, and this is not a coincidence, that's part of my own work. So, you know, in the sense of why would I be watching these films or listening to this music? And so I was aware that I was channeling something really precious, but from which I felt that I had become estranged.
That is a wonderful answer. I love your answers, how everything is feeding into everything else. Mm-hmm. It's all extremely connected. And so that brings me to the question. I know that you've been keeping diaries for a long, long time. How do the diaries relate to your interest in nostalgia? Do they feed that nostalgia? Do they in some way placate the nostalgia, make it easier? Or do they sharpen it and make it more painful? I'd like you to talk more about the diaries, but to that particular point, what would you say?
Yeah, well, what of course I did over many years was to digitize those old diaries, which meant that I couldn't help but annotate what I had done, because the diaries I used to write were just in paper format, like you get from W.H. Smith or Woolworths. And it was one of those like week to a page diaries. So all those years later, because of all the memories I had of the people that I knew, I was thinking, but there was so much more. That was such a momentous occasion. Yet, you know, those three or four lines don't do enough. So I was then fleshing out, annotating all of those events, aware that my memory, of course, is going to play a role in this. And sometimes I'd be thinking, I think it was on this occasion that blah, blah, blah happened. And then there might be an entry a few weeks later. I thought, oh, no, that was the occasion. I was annotating. So actually what I was doing is going back over and finding that the diary in some cases was qualifying. Sometimes it was actually completely corroborating, but qualifying, correcting experiences, because I might have a memory of something that I'd seen or done. And all these years later, I might think that was one of the most important events of my life. But the diary might not have anything in it that suggests that it was that momentous. And vice versa, that stuff that seemed really big at the time, you look back and think, oh, you know, what was the big deal? But so what the diary was doing was helping me see what I thought at the time and the lens I was looking at it back through all these years later. So
it's fascinating. I mean, that's a real laboratory for understanding how the difference between experience and memory. I mean, what you're doing, going back and glossing it, that's fascinating.
But it was also like, it was a kind of going back through something, I mean, I'm not going to say traumatic, because in those days, those were not traumatic days, but they were helping me see things from the present in a way that made me think, well, this is what I was actually doing rather than what I imagined. You know how memories are composite? Sure. Sometimes you think, oh, they were wonderful days. It's like, no, you look and think, worried about next exam or worried about essay mark or what about my accommodation for next year? What am I going to do with the rest of my life? So the diary has got those things in it. But it's easy to look back and think that because maybe things worked out in many ways that you got a good essay mark or you passed that exam or whatever
it might be. That's only hindsight, right?
Hindsight. So the diary is a corrective against the rose-colored lens element, which I'm absolutely guilty of. Of course, there's an element of that. But in some cases, the diary was proving that these people mattered and why they mattered. And I was able to, through the annotations I was making, able to show how their presence in my life was such a felicitous one, was one that it was just that we all connected, and we all connected because we were all obviously the same age doing humanity subjects, because that's what Lampeter offered. But also we all chose to go somewhere to do a degree that was small, that was where most of our peers didn't go, because most people maybe have gone eastwards rather than westwards. And what we were finding is that there were people from that era who all connected with each other. We all had so much in common. Our interests were shared and we all gelled really well because we'd all made the sort of choices that maybe even our closest friends at school didn't make because they chose to stay in the big city or whatever it might have been. So we all came together at the age of 18 by doing something that may be a little bit atypical in terms of the choice. You know, I had a friend at school who said, I want to go to Manchester. And this was in the early 90s when the Manchester music scene was becoming awesome. So that was like the way forward.
Also, I think, as you say, that the place plays a real role, that I've often thought that I made such close friendships in Lampeter because you're thrown together in such a small place. That there are not a lot of distractions around, that you talk more and you talk to the same people and you go deep with those people. If we had been in a city, if we had been in London or in Manchester, anywhere, we would have been out doing different things all the time. It really matters. I think there is a difference to being in Lampeter than other
colleges. I think it's a seminal thing in the sense that because you're all 18 and you just left home, that it feels that the things that went on in those 3 years, well, we had our lives ahead of us. Uh-huh. It kind of meant that we were inclined to, as you say, meet up with the same people regularly, go deep with people. It was also a way, perhaps, and it was a way of correcting against the things that other people maybe in Manchester or London were doing. Because we were all in Lampeter, we knew that in many cases there were some limitations. For example, if you, and this wouldn't have been for me, but if you wanted to go to a nightclub, it was a lot harder to go to a nightclub than it would have been if you were in a city.
Right, so what exactly. It meant is
you just turned up to your advantage. And you knew that going to a nightclub or the cinema wasn't something you could do of an evening. So you didn't then say, oh, I'm disappointed because I want to go to the cinema, but I can't. Or I'm really miserable, I'm going to go to bed. You would just actually do something that you couldn't do or wouldn't even think of doing if you were in the big city. So people would go on walks to the Falkendale Lake, or you would do things that would, even at night sometimes, and people would do things that were just a little bit more unusual compared to what maybe their peers are doing in the big cities.
And more creative, maybe.
More creative.
Right. So I have 9 more minutes, I think, before I have to go. So I just want to know, let's go back to the diary, the diary project. Yeah. So there's nothing more personal than keeping a diary. Yeah. But I know that you've been writing from the diaries. Mm. You're making the leap from the personal to the public. And that, to me, when I talk to my students about what creative nonfiction is at heart, especially memoir, it's not so much telling your story as finding a way to connect your personal story to universal experience, to those universal experiences we all share. I mean, that's what creative nonfiction is. How are you doing that? How do you see that springboard happening? Are you struggling with it? Because it's very hard.
Yeah. Well, in a funny way, the diary became this, and this is somebody who did a PhD on redemption and salvation and teaches in this area. The diary unexpectedly became a form of salvation because something happened to me around 2016 onwards where somebody appeared in my life who seemed the most perfect person I could ever meet. And it turned out that, and the diary can sort of help you sort of, you go backwards and think, oh, this is where it didn't all fit together. Somebody who didn't perhaps check out or didn't perhaps turn out to be the person who she was promising to be. And what was really funny is that I was keeping this copious record of, this is amazing. Who'd have thought that at this moment in my life, I've met my soulmate and all that sort of stuff. And it turned out that there were certain things going on, which from the point of view of now, perhaps seemed a little bit too good to be true. So what I was finding is that at that period, I was keeping a comprehensive record, a copious record of what was going on in my life. But I didn't think that I'd be using it for the purposes of trying to almost like be a detective in my own story, in my own noir type.
How interesting. Yeah. That's a fascinating role to play.
And this is the funny thing. If I'd said now to you, something really weird happened, so therefore I'm going to write it from the point of view of a diary, or I'll start writing a diary, or I'll put together all these ingredients, that would be fine and a good use of my time and energy. But what happened is that I already had all the resources. And this is the funny thing, the person concerned used to ask me questions like, oh, I'm fascinated by your diary and what do you write in it? So I was aware that the fact that I kept a diary was of interest to the other person. And all the stuff that I used to record, and often record the stuff that she would say and she would tell me, almost feels, maybe I'm reading too much into it, almost as though I was writing it all down because she was giving me all those sort of pointers. It was almost as though she thought, here's a guy who writes a diary. He does all these things. He's going to write about me. So therefore, she was feeding me stories, which of course would get into the diary. So looking back, it's almost as though the fact that I kept a diary also, and this is because the diary is a very sacred form, a very personal, but I kind of feel that in some ways, the things I was recording, the events that happened, were kind of just being driven by this whole, well, he's the narrator in his own story. So depending on which path he can be maybe shaped or, you know, sort of prodded or pushed into, then in that sense, she could be the one of the key narrative drivers.
So the character.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I joke about this, but in some ways, and I'm also very conscious that I suddenly realized, I was just thinking the other day that suddenly sort of, I don't want this to be a sort of misogynistic, you know, look what this person did. But actually, no, what happened is that it felt like, here's me writing on film noir from a PhD, writing on the femme fatale, writing on all of these things. And then suddenly somebody appears in your life who references all of these films, the Scorsese and the nostalgia, which you claim to be studying as part of our own research. You know, suddenly all these things that mattered to me, the radio interest, suddenly she occupied, she inhabited, she colonized.
Right.
So the diary is this record of like a body of evidence. And yet I've kept the diary all my life. So suddenly I thought, I'm sitting on a gold mine, but it was like, this is just the weirdest thing, because it feels like on so many levels, it's this, it becomes both the like a secondary source and a primary source
at once.
And a work in progress. Yeah.
That gave me chills as you talked about that, because it almost seems, like you've become a scribe rather than the narrator, the principal narrator, and that it's being dictated by another person, almost as if your diary has become a film.
Yeah. And that's why, so I wasn't in a great place a few years ago, but what I have is this very exhaustive record of things. So what I did was go back over all of those events, and I had to do it because so many people were hearing my story of what's gone on, and people who knew her as well. And then, you know, the number of people who'd say, oh, you should write it all down. And I thought, well, actually, I already have. That's the thing. So what I then did, it's taken me a few years to do it, to go through all over those diary accounts over the course of 2 years or so and try and piece together, take out all the extraneous bits, all the bits about the what I had for breakfast in the morning or what I was writing the day, and just focus on this dynamic. And the question now is, what do I do with that? And that's the next question. But I feel I had to do it because I was in channeling everything into that account, into that memoir, whatever it's called. I was also then not telling everybody the story. So kind of way, that became my channel, my conduit. It kind of ensured that I was
working
able to isolate
through it. And now there's the next step of how do you then frame this story in a way that makes it relatable to others? Like how do you open up parts of it to universalize in a sense? I mean, that's how I see the challenge of creative nonfiction.
Absolutely. And the next step, I think you're right, is then when you find out and in the events that followed, bumping into people who then would say, oh, I knew this person. And then they tell you their account of the person. And then you'd think, oh my word, what you've just told me, you know, or they'd say, oh, we had this amazing thing in common. And the thing they had in common, that might have to do with sports, had nothing in, you know, was not the same thing that I had in common.
That you had at all.
So this was some sort of episode, agenda, that whatever the purpose of all that was, all I can talk about is the impact it had on me. I can't work out, I can't diagnose her, but I can work out how this impacted on me.
Right. And how other people will come to that is not through necessarily a similar experience to yours, but an experience that had that kind of impact on them. And they'll say, oh yes, I had that feeling too, almost as if my life were being dictated by somebody else or it was out of my control. It might not be a romantic experience or even with another person. It could be with a place or whatever. But that's will be your goal at some point if you write this out, how to engage a similar reaction in the reader or lead them to experiences in their memory.
And also you're right, because the danger is that just becomes you could get caught up in your own world.
Right, exactly.
Happened to me.
Well, diaries are personal. Books are for the public through the personal. All right, I have one last question. God comes along and says, Chris Deasy, you are my favorite human. How can I help you? What do you desire? Do you desire something for yourself? Do you desire something for all of us? Think about your answer.
Okay.
You can have actually two answers.
I can have two. Okay. Well, this is what I would do. I think I would do. Because I've written so comprehensively about what happened 20, 30 or more years ago, and I mentioned particular episodes in The Quarry in Lampeter in 1992, that kind of thing. There is a part of me that would like to go back, and maybe not for the whole of, not forever, but maybe in a Groundhog Day type thing where I have a chance to revisit my younger self, maybe in some cases.
As your older self?
As my older self.
Okay.
And just ask myself, how did I get from here? And maybe those moments, which were amazing and fun, to a place some years later that wasn't quite so. And also thought, well, this is kind of where the journey started for me at the age of 18. I started living and just thinking, what if I had taken this step rather than that step?
Right.
You know, in a way, it's a dangerous thing. It's an indulgent thing, because I often wonder, and I talk about this in the podcast with other people, would you end up of just, you know, would you have just made the same choices irrespective of where you've gone or what, you know? So you all end up in the same place eventually. There may be some element of truth in that. Are we in some way, not pre-programmed, but our dispositions are such that we're kind of going to be guided.
We'll always take that same step.
Yeah, same step. So there is a part of me that would want to do that. I think also that there's a part of me, I mean, I suppose in a way that's maybe the more selfish sort of angle. I want to go back. But also it's to help other people who along the way, who maybe either were with me in those days or who could benefit from the fact that this indulgence, which is what it ultimately is a chance to be able to jump forward in time and say, okay, maybe we take certain paths because it's expedient at the time, but actually looking back, you have to follow your heart, because I'd have loved and maybe still would love a career in radio. I didn't follow it. I don't regret anything I did at Lampeter, but there may have been a point, and maybe I could go back and find that point where I think, okay, I didn't have to continue down the path I'm on. I could have done the thing that I wanted to do with such passion when I was a younger boy.
Do you think that option is still ahead of you, as well as possibly behind you?
Well, whereas a few years ago, there was the door marked the past, and I wanted to go through that, and the future felt blocked. I didn't know what the future had in store. I now feel that I've got one door in the past, one door in the future, and the future is exciting me.
As much as the one
that was there before. And a few years ago, I would have said, no, I want to go back. I want to go back. Here, I want to go back in order to move forward rather than just to relive all of those events all over again.
That is the perfect conclusion to this interview. I love that. That's a wonderful answer. And it's a happy answer. And I'm glad you said that.